and on ABC Radio and on your pod, you're with me, Noel Debien, on The Good Life. This month of May is a time of celebration for Buddhists in Australia and many parts of the world, because the Buddha's birthday falls this month. So in The Good Life, we're talking about some of the basics of Buddhism. By percentage, it's the fastest growing religion in Australia, and there are now nearly 500,000 Buddhists here. Some are ethnic Buddhists from various migrant groups, places from Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka, but many now are also Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Celt converts. The Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama has been particularly successful in attracting Western converts. But today's guest in The Good Life is not a Tibetan. He's a Theravadan. This is the teaching of the elders, as it's sometimes called. It's a very old and early form of Buddhism, and Theravada is most obvious in its monasteries in Thailand, Laos, and Kampuchea. Their monks receive the title of Bante, which literally means Venerable Sir in the Pali language. Well, Bante Teja Damo works with the engaged Buddhists, a group including many forms of Buddhism, not just his own Theravadan tradition.
My name is Bante Teja Damo, and I'm a Buddhist monk. I live at Sangha Lodge in Lewisham, and this is the centre for the Association of Engaged Buddhists.
Bante Teja Damo, now that's an interesting term. That engaged Buddhism says something, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it does. I think Buddhism really is about detachment, which is not the same thing as disengagement. And so we try to engage in useful and fruitful and beneficial activities for the community that we live in, and at the same time we try to practice detachment.
The Buddha lived, you know, some 2,500 years ago. He wandered. In the Western tradition, wandering is often seen as a sign of punishment. You know, the Jews wander in the desert, and the idea of wandering is often seen as something bad. But in Buddhism, this wandering is not necessarily a bad thing, is it?
No, it's not, because it's tied up with the idea of homelessness, which is meant to contrast with the Indian notion of the home dweller or the person who sets up a household. But it's not unfamiliar to the Western tradition, because you have all of the mendicant orders of friars in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance in Europe. Their whole idea, if this is St. Francis of Assisi, his whole idea was that they should not have monasteries and convents. They should wander. Well, the friars soon changed that.
Of course they did. But that idea of detachment from worldly things is, of course, is a principle among Christian monastic traditions. But in the older Buddhist monastic tradition, it certainly was a principle, detachment from physical things.
Yes, and it still is. That at least is the ideal, that a monk or a nun actually owns personally very, very little. They own their clothing they wear, they own the alms bowl that they have, they own the wherewithal to repair the clothing and so on.
So what was the Buddha doing? This has led 2,500 years later to a complex religious tradition, but what was Sakyamuni trying to do when, as a prince, he left everything and walked off?
In the mythic account, and it's important to remember that the account of the Buddha's life has a, if you like, a core of truth to it, historical truth, but the way it's been handed down is really set inside a mythic structure. The Buddha found, as we all find as we grow up and grow older, that lots of things happen that we don't like. And some of those things might seem obvious, but they're things like aging and sickness and death. And the Buddha in the story encounters these things, having been cosseted by his father and kept away from them. The Buddha wanted to find a way to, in his own words, to overcome them, to go beyond them, to go beyond the what he called the dukkha, which is suffering and unsatisfactoriness that arises out of our meeting with those things. So that's what he was looking for. He wasn't looking for neat answers, and he wasn't looking for a religious system or tradition.
You mentioned dukkha, you mentioned suffering, a great principle among the Buddhists. And this is somehow also connected, I think, to the idea of impermanence, of things changing. How is that idea important? What was it that the Buddha noticed about this?
Well, I think the connection between suffering and impermanence is something like this, that a great deal of the suffering that we encounter arises from our identification with other things, or our wanting other things, or our not wanting other things. But the real or the ultimate suffering arises from our attachment to the idea of ourself, you know, like, so it's mine and it's me and it's I and so on. And the Buddha says, if you look really, really carefully, you can see that he already is the seed of suffering and unsatisfactoriness, because as soon as I appropriate something, even if it's only in my mind, as belonging to me, then it becomes special, and then if someone else does something to it, then I get upset. So it's this attachment to things and to ideas and so on, but also the final attachment is this very strong attachment to myself, to the idea of myself and I.
You say something which strikes me. There's a Steve Prothero, who's a professor of religion from Boston University. He made the observance that a lot of Western society works on this Cartesian idea, the Descartes idea of I think, therefore I am. And he suggests that the Buddhist principle is rather I think, therefore I am not.
Oh, that's very neat, but I think it somehow misses the point. I mean, the Buddha encourages us certainly to think and to use our rational mind, but I think the Buddha also sees that there are other ways of knowing things, and these things come closer, really, to older or pre-Cartesian ideas about the nature of knowledge and the way that we know things. So, for example, the Buddha would say it's possible to know something using the intellect in a rational way, but it's also possible to know something by, so to speak, allowing that thing to impress itself upon the heart and mind.
You said before also something about the self not being so important, that the self can be actually, I suppose, an obstacle to being what we should be. Is that a connected idea, that we are striving against this idea of self, which is so popular in the West?
Maybe striving against the idea or the conceptual notion of self, but certainly it's not an attack upon oneself. Yeah? It's very important to recognize that the Buddha taught what he called anatta, which means not self. It doesn't mean no self, it means not self. And there's an important distinction, I think, to be made there. If I can put it this way, my teacher used to say to me regularly, he used to call out, there's an expression in Thai, na bua le yang, you know, it means, are you bored with yourself yet, or are you sick of yourself yet? And he would do it spontaneously. So I might be walking across the courtyard and the shutters would open on his room and he'd call out, you know, are you bored with yourself, are you sick of yourself yet? And because it was so spontaneous, you would answer honestly. And so I would say no, and he'd say, well, hurry up. Yeah? So the idea is hurry up and, in a sense, get over yourself. Get over this attachment to yourself, to your own views and so on, and to this sense that, you know, the self is some kind of solid core of identity, you know, rather than something that is in flux all the time.
In the world of Australia or America, where the personality is all, really, you know, defining myself, showing you who I am, refining who I am, finding who I am, all those sorts of things, self-help courses everywhere, that what you're saying is almost in, well, it seems almost complete contrast to that.
Well, not really, because I think if we try to practice anatta, we try to practice recognizing this not-self, yeah, what we find instead is not a kind of nothingness, but what we find is actually our connection with everybody else. So I discover my not-self in your not-self as well. And so I can let go of all of the competitive and perhaps more negative things in my encounters and engagements and meetings and interactions with other human beings and other sentient beings. Because if I can see that my own self is a kind of conceptual construct, then I can see that in you, and so things like taking offence at things that you might say or your views about me and so on, that can just be let go of.
Is Bhante Tejadamo there, though? Is there someone there?
Well, someone's here because I experience suffering. I had an old philosophy lecturer once who used to talk about Jean-Paul Sartre, and he used to say, you know, drop a huge rock on his foot and you'll find out about the realism of knowledge. So something is here, something's happening.
The Buddha, after he had reached, in this story, enlightenment, after he'd come to an understanding of the way things were or were not, he shortly gave a sermon, his first sermon at Sarnath. He spoke of the Four Noble Truths, and this is part of the key teaching of Buddhism. Tell us about those.
Well, the Buddha simply said, first of all, there is the undeniable truth of dukkha, of the existence of this suffering and unsatisfactoriness. That is, that each of us encounters old age, sickness, death, to put it in those simple terms. Each of us has the experience of I want, I want, I want, and the suffering that arises from that, or I don't want, take it away, and the suffering that comes from that. So that's the first. And he calls it a noble truth because when it forms part of the, if you like, the overall plan or schema of his teaching, it leads to a liberation. And then the second truth is the cause of the truth. It's actually a medical diagnostic model. So you have the illness, the fact that you are ill. Then you have, let's find the cause, the diagnosis. So that the cause for the Buddha is grasping or craving or clinging onto things. Yeah? And this the Buddha calls tanha, which literally means a kind of a desperate thirstiness. Yeah? And then the third one is that the suffering can come to an end. Yeah? Now, without that third one, that would be like going to a doctor who says, well, you know, this is your condition, this is the cause of it, and I'm sorry, but I can't do anything about it, it's terminal, yeah? It's fatal. And the Buddha says, well, no, it's not. And how does he know? He knows based on his own experience. And then the last of the Four Noble Truths is, okay, how do you do this? If you like, it's kind of the medicinal or the pharmaceutical, you know, that's given to you. And in this, the Buddha sets out sort of eight steps.
So this is now the Noble Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. So the Fourth Noble Truth tells the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah. Now, what are those eight ideas?
So I've actually got them right here because I brought, strangely, I actually brought the sermon with me, the very first teaching. And so the eight factors are right view. The word right in Pali is sama, which actually means whole or complete. It means right as well, but it's better to think of it as whole or complete. So it's a whole view, it's a complete view. Right resolve or right determination, right speech, because for the Buddha, speech is very important. He calls the tongue the most dangerous of all weapons. Right action, that is how we conduct ourselves, how we are in the world, if you like. Right livelihood, how we support ourselves in the world. So there are some livelihoods the Buddha says a person should not engage in, such as the selling or manufacture of weapons. Right effort, and in this time that we live in, people put a lot of effort into a lot of spiritual paths, and if we don't have the right kind of effort or we don't have the right balance, we can put a lot of effort into something that turns out to be fruitless. Right mindfulness is the kind of awareness that we try to cultivate. And then the last one is called right concentration, but really it's meant to be the right kind of way or the whole way of bringing the mind together or the mind and heart together to encounter reality. And part of reality is oneself.
The Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, what have they meant for you practically in your life? What has it resulted in for you to this point? Because that's what the good life's about, how people live their lives coherently.
Maybe I can answer that question by not answering it, instead by telling you a little story. The Buddha's mother died when the Buddha was only 7 days old. And so he was brought up by a stepmother. Her name was Mahapajapati Gautami. And after the Buddha came to enlightenment, that is, became free of dukkha, she went to him and she asked him, she said, teach me the Dhamma, that is his teaching, his way of doing things, in a nutshell. And it's very interesting because the Buddha did not say to her, okay, here's the Four Noble Truths, yeah, here's the Noble Eightfold Path, have you got that? Yeah, now I'll give you another list. No, he looked at her and he said, there are these things within your own heart and mind or within your own experience that when you look at them, you know this thing leads to, and he says, for example, this thing leads to grasping, not letting go. This thing leads to passion, not to dispassion, yeah? And so on. And he said, when you see these things, he said, you can know for yourself, this is not Dhamma. This is not the teaching of the Buddha. This is not the way of the Buddha. And similarly, he says to her, when you look into your own heart and mind, into your own experience, you know that there are certain things, oh, this thing leads to letting go, not to picking up, Yeah, this thing leads to dispassion, not to passion, passion in a bad sense, that is, and so on. And he says, when you see these things within, so to speak, the stream of your own heart and mind, you know this is Dhamma. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So the Buddha says, you don't have to run around collecting lists of things. You don't have to go to books. You don't have to look here, there, and everywhere. You look at what's going on in your own heart and mind, and you use a little bit of careful observation and careful thinking, and you see, oh, okay, if I go in this direction, I suffer, or somebody else suffers, or we both suffer, you know? And if I go in this direction, I don't suffer, and the other person doesn't suffer, and maybe we actually both benefit.
The answer is within.
Oh, yes. But we can't be living within all the time. We live in the ordinary world. Yeah, look, if people can't be quiet sometimes, yeah, and listen, then they'll never hear anything. Yeah, and if they can't do that, they'll never hear what's really going on inside themselves.